Hello there. Today is Wednesday, September the 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Hillary Clinton is still resting, but she's got some high-profile surrogates campaigning on her behalf.
There is just one candidate in this race who's devoted her life to building that America.
Does age matter when it comes to leading the United States? An Israeli icon is hospitalized after suffering a stroke.
He's really the last of the founding fathers of Israel.
Also ahead, Lady Gaga coming out with a new album. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, we begin with the constantly changing U.S. presidential campaign. Republican Donald Trump rolled out a plan Tuesday aimed at making child care more affordable, an issue more often discussed by Democrats. Trump is also pledging to be the president of everyone. At a campaign rally in Iowa Tuesday, he continued to capitalize on Hillary Clinton's declaration that half of the Republicans' supporters belong in a, quote, basket of deplorables.
Well, my opponent slanders you as deplorable and irredeemable. I call you hardworking American patriots who love your country and want a better future for all of our people.
Clinton later said she regrets saying that. And while Clinton recuperates from a bout of pneumonia, President Obama hit the campaign trail in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on her behalf, where he vigorously defended Clinton.
In the middle of crisis, she'll listen to people and she will keep her cool and she treats everybody with respect. And no matter how daunting the odds, no matter how many times people knock her down and mess with her, she does not quit. She doesn't quit.
Hillary Clinton will resume campaign travel Thursday. Joining me now is senior reporter for Politico, Darren Samuelson. Darren, this illness, will it impact her campaign in the long term?
I think it depends on just how she recovers, how quickly, and what she looks like when she's back out on the stump. She is going to get the benefit of the doubt from all of her supporters that she has pneumonia, and everyone who has ever been sick will relate to that, who is sort of in the Clinton camp. But, you know, for the people who haven't made up their mind yet, and there are still a couple of them out there, especially in the key battleground states, you know, it's going to be important to watch how Clinton responds, what she looks like when she's debating Donald Trump in less than 2 weeks, in that first big debate, and then the two more that follow. Does she, go toe-to-toe with him? Does she swing hard? I can imagine that's going to be one of the most highly watched moments of this entire campaign. Hard to believe that's possible, but no doubt we're going to see millions and millions of Americans tuning in for that debate. And so I think that will be the test, is how does she recover? And so, you know, she does need to take off a couple of days to get better. I think that that's probably the smart move. I'm sure it's not easy for her to do. If you are running for president of the United States, you want to be on the trail. You want to be, you know, responding to everything and attending the events that you've been scheduled to attend. But she does have surrogates from former President Bill Clinton, her husband, to her daughter and vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine. So, you know, there's no shortage of Democrats out there campaigning for her while she's recovering.
Right. And of course, President Obama campaigning in Philadelphia. You know, he's still pretty popular among Democrats in this country. But apparently she hasn't been able to woo all of his supporters her way. It sounds like maybe they've got some plans to work on that.
Yeah, I think working that Obama coalition, that famous Obama coalition that elected him in 2008 and then again in 2012, which is a coalition that includes minority voters, black voters, Hispanic voters, Asian American voters, and then young millennial voters. I mean, those are the keys that Clinton is trying to resurrect and bring back into her tent. She had Chelsea Clinton, I think, was campaigning aiming at millennials earlier. You're going to see more of that. I think you're going to see the president, who has been speaking very forcefully about how he doesn't think Donald Trump is up to taking the reins as commander-in-chief, saying that over and over again. I think a big question will be, how much do they use Michelle Obama, one of the probably more popular people in America right now? Do they put the first lady out there campaigning for a former first lady? And Joe Biden, also very popular, and what role does he play? And certainly, I think President Obama, the more he does down the stretch, the more helpful he's going to be for Hillary, especially with, you know, all of those constituents that are really part of the Obama coalition.
You mentioned the first lady. You know, we have not seen or heard from Melania Trump. since the convention.
Yeah, that's a great point. That is something that people have been wondering. Where is she, and does she really? I think it took a lot for her to give that big speech, and obviously that speech ended up becoming something of a black eye for the Trump campaign, as parts of it were lifted from Michelle Obama's, one of her previous Democratic convention speeches. So I think Melania Trump maybe hasn't really been a very big surrogate for Donald Trump, and I would imagine stays back out of the picture here going forward, too.
He's also unveiling some proposals that seem very Democratic-like.
Yeah, Donald Trump is certainly trying to cross over and appeal to voters that would be, you know, some of the very same people that traditionally had gone Democratic, especially in some of these Midwestern battleground states. So yeah, on education, you are seeing Donald Trump trying to play a little bit more to a different mindset. Same thing on foreign policy. He's talking like someone who would not engage in some of the foreign entanglements that we have seen previous administrations get into. And it's interesting because you have Hillary Clinton there, you know, with a lot of Republicans, including former Bush administration officials, who have taken her side. So you kind of do have this cross over effect happening with both candidates and some of the policies as they try and play to the bipartisan middle and trying to cross over to the other party's voters.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. Now, with the issue of health front and center in the campaign right now, the topic of the candidate's age is coming into the conversation. Hillary Clinton is 68. Donald Trump is 70. Joining me now to talk about whether age really matters, Dr. S.J. Olshansky, professor of public health at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Doctor, first off, will Hillary Clinton's age slow her recovery from pneumonia?
Well, they can get over it just like anybody else. It's a little harder at 70 than it is at 60 or 50, but you have to realize that health issues always tend to accumulate as we get older. And there's no question that both Hillary and Donald are going to be, whichever one is elected president, is going to be the oldest or close to the oldest president ever elected. And frankly, the fact that we're not paying, at least until recently, we're not paying that much attention to their age is the good news. Their age should be completely irrelevant to this entire process. One or more of them are going to release their medical records. And then the question is, what does the general public do with the results that come from those medical records? We really don't know how to make use of any of that information and whether or not that information can be used to make a judgment about these individuals is questionable. Even if they have a condition like diabetes or high blood pressure or, you know, hypertension, you know, whatever it is, these are treatable conditions even at their age at 70. And also keep in mind that there are even people who make it out into their 80s, even mid-80s, who are perfectly healthy in both mind and body. So age should not be an issue at all.
And if we do see these medical records, what should people look for? What should they say if we wanted to know something about the state of someone's health, if they're able to handle such a rigorous job?
About the only thing we should be paying attention to, in my view, is whether or not they are facing some sort of serious illness that would impair their mental functioning. I'm not worried about somebody not being able to walk normally or, I mean, you know, we've had presidents who have not had the ability to walk normally. But mental impairment, that's a different issue. And that's probably about the only thing I would look for. Even survival issues are difficult to get at. Keep in mind that these individuals who are running for president and people that have run for president before, these represent in general, the wealthiest, most highly educated subgroups of the population that have access to health care. They tend to live longer than just about anyone else. They tend to handle stress with very effectively, perhaps more effectively than many other people. You know, I don't even think that most people half the age of either Hillary or Donald could go through the schedule that these two are going through now in these 100 days before the election. I mean, they are nonstop traveling. They are not sleeping in their own beds. It's an extraordinarily grueling time for them. You know, probably being president is a relief relative to these 100 days. But beyond that, in terms of normal health-related issues like, you know, pneumonia, hypertension, you know, everyone at that age has something. You know, it may not be obvious, it may not be life-threatening, but we all have something once we get up into our late 60s and early 70s. Most of these issues are treatable, and they should not influence the functioning of these two individuals.
at all.
So somebody asked me about why there's an age limit of 35 to become president. And the founding fathers, as I understand it at the time, believed that you had to be at least the age of 35 in order to acquire enough wisdom and experience to operate as president. Well, if you're 70 in theory, then you should have twice the wisdom and twice the experience of somebody who is 35. So age really should not be a variable at all.
All right. Well, we appreciate your insights. Dr. S.J. Olshansky, professor of public health at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Possible Russian meddling with U.S. elections worries key defense officials. The U.S. and Israel sign a record military aid deal. Could green salads, olive oil, and exercise reverse Alzheimer's? The NFL's Colin Kaepernick protests against racial inequality continue. And U.S. students fail the world literacy test. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Former Israeli President and Prime Minister Shimon Peres is in serious but stable condition after suffering a stroke on Tuesday. He experienced heavy bleeding in the brain, according to hospital officials who said doctors raced to stabilize the 93-year-old. Joining me now is Noah Pollack, a contributing writer for the Washington-based Weekly Standard newspaper. Talk about what this man means to the Jewish nation.
He's really the last of the founding fathers of Israel. I mean, Israel's a very young country. It was founded in 1948. And, you know, in America, our, you know, George Washington's and Thomas Jefferson's are, you know, hundreds of years old now. And in Israel, a few of these guys are still alive. And the last person who died before him of that stature was Ariel Sharon, who himself had a terrible stroke in 2006 and then died several years later. The real significance of this for Israel is he's the last of the founding fathers who's still alive. And this may be, it seems like, a very serious stroke. And obviously you hope he recovers, but it seems to be very serious. And he might be really the last of the founding fathers to pass away.
What is his legacy for Israel? What, tell us, for those that may not know, all of the different positions that he's held and what he's done for the nation. Obviously, he has a deep love for Israel.
He was born in Poland in the 1920s, and his family immigrated to what was then British mandate-controlled Palestine. The British controlled what's today Israel, and with his family in 1932. And he, in the 1930s and 40s, as a young man, rose through the ranks of the pre-state Jewish state, the military and the government. And he was one of the guys who was present at the creation and helped actually create the state. And in the 40s and 50s and 60s, he was a member of Knesset, of Israel's parliament. He ended up serving as prime minister briefly twice. He was president. He served in the parliament from 1959 until 2007. He held numerous positions in both the defense ministry and in the sort of political echelons that oversee Israel's military. I mean, there's almost nothing he didn't do in that time. And he was one of the key decision makers on a number of the most important decisions that Israel faced as a country. And for the kind of psyche of the country, remember, Israel's a very, very small country. It's tiny. It's the size of New Jersey. To lose someone like that, you know, in a certain way, in the psyche of the country, people sleep well at night because they know that people like Shimon Peres are still around, and those guys who had what it took to found the state and to defeat the people who tried to destroy the state early on when Israel was very weak and very poor, that those guys were still around. And now this is really passing the torch on to the next generation and to see that if the next generation of leaders can also pass that test.
He's also a Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Peres politically is on the left, and he was a longstanding Labor Party member, and he is part of the original Oslo Accords in the 90s with Arafat and Clinton and Yitzhak Rabin, who was the prime minister at the time. They all won Nobel Peace Prizes. Of course, that peace is not actually been achieved. And Perez, you know, his sort of later, his later career in the past 10 or 15 years has been more marked by him as a kind of inspirational figure who speaks aspirationally about the hope for peace and how Israel wants peace. So he's sort of had an elevated status in the world as one of Israel's kind of elder statesmen. And a lot of that is because, you know, he says many of those things that people want to hear about the need for peace and the hope for peace.
If and when he passes away, will he overwhelmingly be remembered with love from the people of Israel?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Israel is very similar to the United States, but it's also different in that there are a lot of leaders who, for example, in other countries like in America are viewed as controversial, like Sharon in Israel was almost completely beloved because he saved the country. I mean, he literally in some of the wars almost single-handedly saved the country. And Perez, he also has that military record, not like Sharon's, but he was a key person in the military. But his legacy is more of a more dovish kind of peacemaker kind of figure. And I think one of the main things he's done for Israel later in his career is he's reminded the world that Israel wants peace and seeks peace and has those hopes. Israelis will always appreciate that, and they'll always appreciate the fact that this is a man who gave his entire life from the time he was a teenager and into his 90s, making the case for Israel and standing up for Israel. And he was a man of the left, but he was not of the left that was expressed contempt in kind of unfair criticism of his own country. He always would stand up for Israel when people criticized Israel. He's admired and beloved for that.
What kind of a relationship did he have with his counterparts here in the U.S.?
In the Obama years, was actually had a number of fairly close friendships with people in Obama's circle. And I know that he was quietly involved kind of behind the scenes as a conduit of information and as a kind of communication channel. When things between the White House and the Prime Minister's office were not as healthy, you know, Perez sort of maintained these friendships because he could, because he wasn't so intimately involved. He could play the role of the elder statesman. And I think that you'll see the Obama administration, Hillary Clinton, I mean, everyone will, I think, be quite effusive in their praise of his legacy and in what he stood for.
Well, we certainly are wishing him a speedy recovery. Thank you so much for being here. Weekly Standard contributing writer Noah Pollack. Well, a U.S.-Russian negotiated ceasefire in Syria has reportedly been holding for the most part. It's the second attempt by both countries to halt the country's 5-year civil war and bring the parties back to the negotiating table on Syria's political future. U.N. Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura.
Comparing the bottom line to previous days, there is no doubt a significant drop in violence.
DeMistura says if the cessation of hostilities holds, there may be a meeting of the coalition of some 20 countries trying to end the conflict on the sidelines of next week's gathering of world leaders at the United Nations in New York. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Time now to check in with G. Abby Lee for what's been trending online on social media. Gee, you've been following the latest buzz on two of the world's leading handset manufacturers.
Hi, Lori. I've been following the news on my mobile phone no less, and Apple is once again trending, but this time not about the new iPhones. The online community is talking mostly about a couple of changes to its iMessaging system And the first is that Apple replaced its gun emoji with a water gun emoji. And this is what people are saying. So Apple thought it was okay to take away the gun emoji and replace it with a water gun, but give a middle finger one? Another person wrote, "How am I supposed to convey my anger with water gun? Hashtag iOS 10. Hey, if you have to convey your anger with gun emoji, I feel like that's a little bit problematic.
Yeah, that's silly. And what's the other change?
The introduction of iMessage stickers. There is now a separate app store for iMessage offering users an assortment of stickers to choose from. Many accounts are tweeting about the stickers, and especially and understandably, the companies have created stickers with Apple. They include characters from Pixar animations, the Star Wars film series, and Nintendo's Super Mario computer game. But just as many people are pointing out that similar products have existed on Samsung mobile phones for a long time. And it seems like not everyone is happy with the change either. One person tweeted, "I like Apple because emojis don't trigger me." That means she's not annoyed by the current emojis. Why is Apple trying to be Samsung?
Well, speaking of Samsung, are people still talking about the recall of the latest Galaxy Note?
Yes, they are. And one of the most liked tweets on the topic argued, American actress Kate Upton is built like a Samsung charger. Now, as you know, the Korean conglomerate is recalling its latest line of mobile handsets because some of its batteries have been exploding. And the previous tweet is referring to Upton's rant on Twitter and Instagram. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's actually a pretty long spiel, how she disagrees with some of American football team Miami Dolphins players who refuse to stand up during the national anthem on September 11th. That's all for me today, Lori.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Lady Gaga fans have reason to rejoice. After 3 years, she's finally got a brand new song and is also coming out with a brand new album, as VOA Border Crossings host Larry London talks about with International Edition's Ira Melman.
It'll be album number 5, pop album number 5, although she did release a jazz album with Tony Bennett a couple of years ago called Cheek to Cheek, but she's back into the pop world. And the new album does not have a title yet, but her latest single, which we've waited 3 years for, does have a title.
And what is that?
It's Perfect Illusion. I really like the song. It just came out last week, and it's already creating quite a buzz and moving up the charts. And Lady Gaga has shown that she can do just about everything. She is a great actress. She's appearing on a drama show on sci-fi television called American Horror Story. She won a Golden Globe for her role on the show. She's nominated for several Emmys for her role on American Horror Story. And she's performed on the Oscars. She sang her tribute to Julie Andrews, Sound of Music. Sounded great. Everybody's review after was, "I never knew Lady Gaga could sing like that."
Well, everybody said that when they first heard all the duos with Tony Bennett, right?
True. Very true. And there's talk of a potential another album with Tony Bennett because she had such a great time and the two of them bonded so well. But her fans, which are known as Little Monsters, they've been craving some new music from Lady Gaga. So we've waited a number of years, and it's time for her to get back into the pop world.
Has she spread herself too thin?
That's a great question. I don't think so. I think that she was very disappointed. The last album that she put out, which was pop, in 2013 called Art Pop, failed miserably. And she blamed it on the record label. She said it was just a failure to promote it properly. I didn't have the support I needed. So the album bombed. And she's coming back and she says, "This album will be bigger and better than anything I've done before."
When she first made it big publicly, she came through with a certain persona. And that persona has changed throughout the years. Is she going back to it?
No, I don't believe she's going to return to that because her fans and her, you know, her base has matured, has grown since she debuted probably about 7-8 years ago. And at the time, we were all enamored by the craziness that was Lady Gaga with the meat dress, which is now at the Smithsonian. and the shoes.
Hope they have it refrigerated.
Nothing wrong with some rotten meat.
Right.
But no, she certainly has come a long way, and I think doing a jazz album with Tony Bennett put her on another path. So I can't see her going back to the craziness that was Lady Gaga, and I don't think her fans are expecting that from her. I think she's always going to be cutting edge and a little bit avant-garde, but you know, she was seen in New York recently. She was dressed very provocatively, so maybe that's the new incarnation of Lady Gaga. She'll be more sexy and more sultry. Who knows? We'll wait and see.
Seems to be what she likes.
Yes. Well, whatever she likes, her fans like, and it seems like the people who like music like, because, you know, everybody's been craving a new Lady Gaga song, and as I mentioned, we waited 3 years for the new song, and it's called Perfect Illusion.
Let's hear more of it, shall we?
Trying to get control, pressure's taking its toll, stuck in the middle zone, I just want you alone. My guessing game is strong, way too real to be wrong.
That's going to do it for this edition of International Edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For a while, it looked like the 2.5-year-old civil war in South Sudan might finally be over. In August of last year, both Salva Kiir and Riek Machar signed a peace agreement to end the conflict, the terms of which confirmed Salva Kiir as president and returned Riek Machar to government as the first vice president. But just months after Riek Machar returned to South Sudan to resume his vice presidential duties, violence resumed and Machar fled. One of the most heinous aspects of South Sudan's civil war is the forced conscription of child soldiers, children younger than 18, with far too many under the age of 15. According to UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Agency, since South Sudan's civil war began in December 2013, over 16,000 children have been recruited into armed groups on both sides. UNICEF has reported on the recruitment of child soldiers since the July 7th outbreak of violence. Both sides are using various methods, including coercion and blackmail, to force parents to surrender their children to them. The United States is profoundly alarmed by the UNICEF report. Above and beyond our calls for an end to ongoing violence in South Sudan, we insist on an immediate halt to the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers by government and opposition forces. Individuals responsible for the unlawful recruitment or use of child soldiers for armed groups or forces may be subject to sanction under U.S. law and may be targeted for U.N. sanctions, said State Department spokesman John Kirby in a written statement. The continued unlawful recruitment and use of children in armed conflict in South Sudan is unacceptable. Eliminating the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers for armed groups in South Sudan is a leading priority of the United States. We remain committed to securing accountability for those who recruit and use children as soldiers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for